In recent years, the United Nations has not reached its full potential because of bureaucracy and mismanagement. While the United Nations on a regular budget has increased by 140% and its staff has more than doubled since 2000, we are not seeing the results in line with this investment.
President Trump at the UN today talking about reforms and budgets. His big moment in front of the General Assembly is tomorrow morning. The big topics for the U.S. are clear: North Korea, Syria, ISIS, and Iran. Trump is on record as late as last week saying the nuclear deal with Iran is, quote, the worst deal ever. And he's no doubt hearing about it from Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu as the two get together on the sidelines of the UN meeting this week. Trita Parsi is president of the National Iranian American Council. He joins us now. Hi there.
How are you?
Great, thanks. Also joining us, Nick Wadhams, foreign policy reporter for Bloomberg News, and he's at the UN General Assembly. Hi.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Okay, let's begin with you. The U.S. and some other countries, including China and France, formed this deal 2 years ago to try to prevent Iran from developing nuclear weapons. And in exchange, Iran got some relief from economic sanctions. So what doesn't President Trump like about this deal?
The big thing he doesn't like about it is that he says it's too narrowly focused. So it focuses on Iran's nuclear activity, but it doesn't take into account its development of ballistic missile technology, also what the U.S. sees as Iran's sort of malign actions in the region, its support for the regime of the Syrian leader Bashar al-Assad, and also its role as a state sponsor of terrorism. So the Trump administration argues that it's too sort of narrowly focused, and then also that a lot of its most restrictive provisions on Iran's nuclear activity expire or start to expire, less than 10 years from now, and then a lot of those restrictions lift completely after 2025, which would sort of allow Iran then, if it so desired, to just continue on the pathway to a nuclear weapon.
And Trita, would it be possible to renegotiate this deal, not pull out of it, but just renegotiate it and make it stronger?
If it ever was possible, Donald Trump has already destroyed that possibility by proving himself to be an untrustworthy negotiating partner. But even if he hadn't done that, to be frank with you, it would have been tremendously difficult. This was a very, very tricky negotiation. It lasted more than 20 months. It was excruciatingly painful for the people involved. Just imagine bringing the Russians, the Chinese, the Europeans, and the Iranians to the table, and throughout all of this managed to ensure that the entire P5+1 were united so that the Iranians couldn't play the big powers against each other. That's going to be virtually impossible for the United States to recreate now. There's no desire for this. The criticism against the deal that Trump has put forward are simply not valid in the eyes of the other countries. If he actually presented something that they agreed upon was a problem, perhaps there would be some willingness. But that's not the case right now.
And Nick, so what are the consequences if the U.S. unilaterally withdraws from this accord?
Well, that's a great question, and it's one that everybody's been trying to answer. I mean, Iran has said that if the U.S. withdraws from the accord, that it would continue to adhere to the stipulations laid out under it, just without the U.S. And the risk here for the Trump administration is that it could leave itself sort of isolated from its allies in the European community that really support this deal. On the other hand, the Trump administration basically says that they see their displeasure with the deal as leverage to be able to target really what I think they see as the most achievable thing right now, which is sort of eliminating what they call these sunset clauses. So sort of putting in some follow-on agreement that would restrict Iran's nuclear uranium enrichment and development of other technologies beyond 2025, when those restrictions really start falling away.
But Trita was noting that it was very difficult to get the agreement that we have right now. So what is the likelihood of getting yet more restrictions?
Well, it really depends on who you talk to. I mean, the administration points to some comments from the French president, who said late last month that France would be willing to have some sort of discussion about possibly looking at some of those sunset clauses later on. But really, those are very sort of vague promises. Really, France, like the rest of the other countries involved, say the deal is working. We need to give it time. It's only been in place for a couple of years. So we'll really start to see this week whether there really is any appetite at all to look at these at a potential new round of discussions for later on.
Okay. And Trita, there is this important deadline coming up in October, and that is the deadline to recertify whether Iran is complying with the deal. The White House has to send this report to Congress. So what happens if they say, we're not going to recertify? I mean, how does that actually work if indeed Iran is complying and they're allowing for inspections?
Sure. Let me also just quickly say something on the idea of renegotiating, you know, the sunset clauses. I would say that that is essentially impossible. The Trump administration believes that they can get a better deal by offering less. And that's simply not going to work. This is not a real estate development project somewhere in Manhattan. This is something far more complex than anything Trump has ever dealt with. So to a certain extent, I believe the naivete that they're coming to the table with is actually precisely because they've never done something like this. Mm. But now what they're playing with is the idea that by October 15th, when the president has to certify to Congress as to whether Iran is living up to the agreement or not, which essentially is going to be based on what the IEA says and what the U.S. intelligence agencies say, he's going to have no choice but to say that the Iranians are living up to the deal, because they are. That's already been certified 8 times by the IEA. But the congressional criteria is actually a bit different. It doesn't only ask the president to do that, but also to be able to state whether the sanctions relief still makes sense for the United States from a broader U.S. national security perspective. And that's the line they're likely going to use to say, yes, the Iranians are living up to the deal, although we think they're violating the spirit, and no one knows what the spirit is, but nevertheless. But we still don't believe that, mindful of Iran's other activities in the region, it is worthwhile lifting the sanctions. Then that kicks the question to Congress, and Congress will have 60 days to decide whether to reimpose sanctions. If Congress does that, which is quite likely, Congress loves to impose sanctions on Iran, then the deal has been fundamentally violated by the United States unilaterally. At that point, it is likely to completely collapse, and the two main negative scenarios that the deal evaded, which was that Iran would have a pathway to a bomb or that there would be a war between the United States and Iran, will be put back on the table.
All right. Trita Parsi, president of the National Iranian American Council, Nick Wadhams, foreign policy reporter for Bloomberg News. Thank you both very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
One of the countries urging the United States to stay in the Iran nuclear deal is Russia. And one of Russia's few ardent supporters in Congress is Orange County Republican Dana Rohrabacher. He says the idea that Russia meddled in the U.S. election is, quote, total bull. For 28 years, Rohrabacher has represented a safe Republican district on the Orange County coast from Seal Beach down to Laguna. But he's one of the OC Republicans Democrats are hoping to unseat in next year's midterms. He's a former Reagan speechwriter. He's a surfer. And his favorite meal is a peanut butter sandwich. As San Francisco Chronicle political reporter Joe Garofoli recently discovered when he visited the congressman at his home in Costa Mesa.
I make sure that I have a little enough differentiation here, because this is crunchy peanut butter, and this is smooth peanut butter that I bought at the 99-cent store. So that was expensive peanut butter, that chunky peanut butter.
Yes. Right?
This is inexpensive peanut butter. This is a buck.
Joe Garofoli joins me now. He's politics reporter at The Chronicle. Hi.
Some high-quality video there that you are sharing the audio with there.
Okay, so give us a quick rundown of your impressions of him.
Well, I mean, he is all over the place, because in addition to what you said about him being, he's more pro-Russia than our president. He also is very pro-marijuana. He was one of the first members of Congress, left or right, to be out there in favor of legalization, even before it was on the ballot here in California this last time and passed. But then he was getting into some weird conspiracy theories when we were talking, particularly about the Charlottesville riot. He says, under his scenario, he said it was former, quote, Hillary and Bernie supporters who got Civil War reenactors to gather there under the guise of protecting a Robert E. Lee statue. And he said, quote, it was a setup for these dumb Civil War reenactors. It was left-wingers who were manipulating them to have a confrontation and to put our president on the spot. That's like, that's Alex Jones InfoWars stuff. So he's kind of out there in that stuff. So, but the guy wins all the time, and not even just by slight margins. He's won 13 of 15 races there by more than 20%.
What do you, why do supporters like him if he is so out there with some of his beliefs?
A couple reasons, I think. Well, first of all, 98% of the people in Congress win re-election. Yeah. The incumbents win. But for him, he represents a part of Orange County that is kind of a OGOC, if you will. You know, this is the whiter, more conservative, wealthier part of Orange County. The other parts of Orange County, as you know, living down there, are changing demographically, are less white, are not as wealthy. And that's still the place. And if you came of age, if you cast your first vote for Ronald Reagan, you have kind of grown up as a voter casting ballots for Reagan and then Dana Rohrabacher, and you have that sort of emotional, if you will, connection to the two of them.
Okay. Meanwhile, he's been trying to broker a deal between Julian Assange and the Trump White House.
Yes.
What is that about?
Yeah. Well, he went there on his own dime to visit Assange. I think it was a summer vacation, a little side trip there. And he, you know, spent time with him, and he said that he has shared sort of the outlines with the White House of what Assange wants. He thinks it's, you know, it would be silly for us not to listen to him, and to, you know, if he has information about the true source of the information that WikiLeaks shared, then why not listen to them and possibly cut him a deal? He thinks that he should be pardoned, you know, if there any crimes he would be charged with.
And he's saying that he believes what Assange says, and that is that Russia did not give him the hacked emails.
He says Russia did not give it to him, and Rohrabacher believes this. And it's an interesting turnaround for him, because Rohrabacher, when he came to office, you know, again, out of the Reagan White House, he was as anti-communist as he could get. He fought with the Northern, or he went on a fact-finding trip with the Northern Alliance in Afghanistan, and fought Soviets. I mean, he actually told me he was part of a unit that was responsible to the deaths of Soviet soldiers. But he draws a line between...
Wait, was he in the military? Or
No. This is a fact-finding trip right before he went into Congress.
And he just strapped on a weapon and started shooting?
Oh, yeah. Search Google Dana Rohrabacher and his time in Afghanistan. You can see him in full costume. Huh. And so he draws a line between being anti-Soviet and anti-Russia. He said we are wasting our money, you know, taking on Russia militarily and being afraid of them. He said we share the same values. We, the United States and Russia, share the same values, and that is being against radical Islam and his telling of this.
Okay, so now he's a defender. And now Democrats think, well, we have a chance, finally. Do they have a chance?
I'm thinking this guy is so out there. Why are we? How can this guy still be in Congress in California? But as I said, his district is so unusual. It's what we said earlier. And so there's several, for a change, he has several challengers, several well-funded challengers in that. And one of them being one of the foremost stem cell researchers in the world. A couple other have been former Republicans who have become Democrats in the last several years. And one of them has a decent amount of money. Rohrabacher's never really had to raise a whole hell of a lot of money for re-election. And so he's doing something. In fact, when I went over to his house, he's sitting on his front porch in an old pair of khakis, and he bought it at Goodwill for $10, he told me, and an old T-shirt, barefoot, on his front step, making fundraising calls. And this is an unusual thing for him. to have to seriously raise money. And because he's traditionally been one of the poorer members of Congress. He's not like a Feinstein or a Pelosi who, you know, has unlimited budget if they were ever challenged.
Yeah. So hence the 99-cent store peanut butter. Is there a chance, though, that he could lose?
Oh, sure. There's a chance. I was down there. We just did a story that ran in the Chronicle today about there's an incredible amount of street energy on the left in Orange County. I mean, it's really unbelievable now, especially for there. There's really not a lot of grassroots organizing that's been down there traditionally, and a lot of it's coming out of reaction to Trump and people like Rohrabacher who are very much aligned with Trump. He was on the short list to be a Secretary of State, or at least discussed at some level. So there is a chance that he could lose, but it's very difficult. Like I said, he is won by 20% almost every time he runs for re-election.
All right. Thank you, Joe.
Thank you.
Joe Garofoli, he is politics reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The Emmys got a little political last night.
We all know the Emmys mean a lot to Donald Trump because he was nominated multiple times for Celebrity Apprentice, but he never won. Why didn't you give him an Emmy? I tell you this, if he had won an Emmy, I bet he wouldn't have run for president.
Stephen Colbert's opening monologue was full of Trump jabs, of course. And the rest of the show, yeah, the message was pretty clear there, too. African-American performers did well. So did women, SNL, Alec Baldwin, The Handmaid's Tale won. So here to recap it all for us is NPR's TV critic Eric Deggans. Welcome back, Eric.
All of it. I'm just going to do a real-time reenactment of everything. So do you have like 3 hours?
We have three plus hours. Okay, so in that opening monologue, Colbert called on a surprise guest to tell the audience how many people might be watching this event.
This will be the largest audience to witness an Emmys, period, both in person and around the world.
Wow, that really soothes my fragile ego.
All right, so that's former White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer. The reaction in the audience was mixed, to say the least. What did you think?
I think the best reaction was Anna Chlumsky's face. they did a close-up
like
of the,
her.
She's a co-star on Veep, and she just could not believe it. If her jaw could have hit the floor, it would have. yeah, there was a decidedly mixed reaction. I guess in the room, it seemed like people enjoyed it a bit more than people did on social media. Mm-hmm. There was a sense that they were joking about a moment when to be charitable, at the very least, Sean Spicer, he came out and insisted that the journalism that said that there were fewer crowds at Trump's inauguration than Obama was wrong, but he was wrong. And so to be charitable, at the very least, he was passing on incorrect information and insisting that the press report it as true in one of his first official duties as press secretary. Yeah. And I just think it's too soon to be joking about that, because that's a central tension between the press and this administration, whether or not the information they're providing is accurate. A lot of people didn't take it very well on social media.
Right. And they're saying, why is he being normalized, this guy who...
Exactly. Why are we pretending like this is a joke when this strikes at the heart of whether or not you can believe what the White House press secretary tells you?
Yeah. Well, Alec Baldwin, he won for Best Supporting Actor in a Comedy, and he also joked about the president. SNL had a good night, right?
SNL had a great night. They won as Best Variety Sketch Series. This is a relatively new category. The variety shows were split up into talk and sketch shows, but a broadcast show hadn't won in variety in quite a while. It tended to be the province of shows like The Daily Show and The Colbert Report when Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert were hosting those shows, and then moved on to, Last Week Tonight, we saw did well, for example. Mm-hmm. example. So to see a broadcast show kind of rise up and put its finger right on the pulse of what's happening, that's a great sign for broadcast. And it was great for NBC, which, you know, had a pretty impressive tally of Emmy wins thanks to SNL, The Voice, and This Is Us.
Well, speaking of making hay and comedic hay of a political moment, Julia Louis-Dreyfus won again.
That never happens.
I keep saying this, she's making history. Is that getting boring? I mean, she keeps winning.
I know. Last year, she made history for 5 consecutive wins as best comedic actress. This year, she made it 6. Next year will be Veep's last year. And if they keep up the quality or somehow manage to make it better, we may be having this conversation again next year. She has a lock on this category. And what's interesting about it, from my standpoint, is that it's hard to quibble with that. She's done a great job on a show that has always been fresh and funny, and this year feels more relevant than ever.
Okay, so women had a good night last night, one of whom was Lena Waithe. And here's a clip from her acceptance speech.
My LGBTQIA family, I see each and every one of you. The things that make us different, those are our superpowers. Every day when you walk out the door, put on your imaginary cape and go out there and conquer the world, because the world would not be as beautiful as it is if we weren't in it. And for everybody out there that showed us so much love for this episode, thank you for embracing a little Indian boy from South Carolina and a little queer black girl from the south side of Chicago. We appreciate it more than you could ever know.
Okay, so she's talking about Aziz Ansari there in Master of None, and she won for Best Writer of a Comedy Series. Tell us about that moment.
Well, first of all, it's kind of hard for me to believe that in 2017, a black woman has not won this award before, but it was true. And not only did a black woman win, but a black gay woman won for co-writing an episode about coming out to her mother and her aunt. And that's an issue that is of key importance, I think, in the black community, key importance in many communities, but particularly in African-American communities, about how gay people are able to come out to their parents, come out to their friends, come out to their family. So that was an episode that just touched a lot of people. And then to see that recognized in the Emmys in the year that it aired. Emmys, you know, years ago were would often catch up to trends late, honor people well after they should have been honored. To see the Emmys honor an episode of television like that, just as people are recognizing how special it is, was also an achievement, I think, for the Emmys. And you want to talk about how women have done. When you look at the shows that have won for Best Drama, Best Comedy, Best Limited Series, Best TV Movie, every one of those shows featured female characters, from Big Little Lies on HBO to The Handmaid's Tale on Hulu to Black Mirror's San Junipero episode. And so it was a great night for women as well at the Emmys.
Okay, speaking of women, I want to play this clip of RuPaul playing Emmy. And here's where Colbert asked Emmy if they could hook up.
You have to ask those divas at Ernst & Young.
Oh, those drama queens are nasty.
Honey.
No.
Uh-uh.
Mm-mm. Lastly, Emmy, do you have any advice for this year's nominees?
I do. Listen up. If you win, own it, share it, love it. But when you get up on that stage, don't say you're surprised how heavy I am, because that's just plain rude. Okay?
It is.
Can I get amen up in here?
Amen.
Okay.
Love him.
You know, I think Colbert should have asked Emmy why she stopped hanging out with him when he moved to CBS. When he hosted the Colbert Report, he and Emmy had a regular relationship. That show often won for especially writing in a variety series. But since he's moved to The Late Show, not so much.
Looks like she sashayed away. Well, what did you think of the job that Colbert did last night?
For me, it was kind of middling. I guess maybe I expected a bit more from him. He had some interesting ideas. You know, that sketch with RuPaul, there was a sketch where he was an android in Westworld. He opened with a dance number, a song and dance number. But inside a lot of these bits, I think the jokes were kind of lacking. And I would love to see him, if he's going to host another show, bring it up a notch.
Maybe RuPaul should host next year.
Oh, RuPaul should definitely host. But I want RuPaul. I don't want RuPaul to host an event that can be as stodgy as the Emmys. I would love to see RuPaul host like the Golden Globe Awards or someplace where people are a little looser and they're willing to say what's on their minds a little bit more and have fun more. Yeah. So my vote is for RuPaul for Golden Globes.
Okay. You heard it here first. You're listening, RuPaul. Get that gun on. Okay. Eric Deggans, TV critic for NPR. Thank you so much.
Always a pleasure.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. You've heard of pink slips. Well, get ready to learn about blue slips. That's what senators can use to block the president's federal judicial nominees in their home states. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, though, is threatening to curtail the process. Also, California lawmakers approved a measure that requires presidential candidates, one in particular, to release their tax returns in order to appear on the state's primary ballot. Jessica Levinson is here to talk about these stories with us. She is a law professor at Loyola Law School and our regular Monday Legal Eagle. Welcome.
Thank you.
Give us a little bit more about these blue slips. I had not heard about this before.
This is such an inside baseball issue, and it's so fascinating because it allows senators to exert an enormous amount of power over a really important process, which is choosing federal judges. And as we've discussed before, federal judges, once they're appointed and their nominations go through the Senate, they're there for life. They're, as they should be, I think, unaccountable to the people. They don't stand for election. They can only be removed by impeachment. And as we're increasingly seeing, particularly throughout the Trump administration, they make really, really important decisions. So the blue slips allow the home state senator basically to prevent a nominee or potential nominee from going forward. So blue slips are kind of like a report card. And you're supposed to, as a home state senator, return them and say, you know, I support or I don't support. But if you don't return it at all, you're basically halting that person from being able to go forward through the nomination process.
Now, and the idea being that you would know what's best for your state and you would know if this judicial nominee would be appropriate for your state.
Right. Well, the idea being that the home state senator is familiar with the potential nominees and that in the Constitution, it requires that the Senate provide advice and consent with respect to judicial nominees. And so that's their way of making sure that they're advised and that they provide consent is basically, you know, ask me, consult me as part of the process. Otherwise, you might not, my blue slip might just get lost in the dry cleaning.
And has that already happened?
It has happened. And people have used blue slips for more than 100 years. And guess who tends to like blue slips is the party in the minority, because this is kind of their only way of exerting power, particularly because we've done away with the filibuster for judicial nominees, which would
and
require.
And the Democrats did that.
Exactly.
But now they want to hold on to their blue slips.
Now, Republicans, when they were in the minority, really liked their blue slips. Suddenly, inexplicably, Republicans, now that they're in the majority, aren't quite as fond as those blue slips. You know, the reasons escape us completely. But the truth is, we have to think about blue slips the way we think about filibuster or any other procedural rule that allows the minority party to exert power. Is we should be honest. If we like this process, if we think it makes sense, which really it doesn't, people should get a floor vote. If you don't like someone, then talk about it in an open debate. You know, let them go through the Judiciary Committee. And you know, of course, all of this is discussed in the backdrop of Merrick Garland, President Obama's nominee who for the Supreme Court for Justice Scalia's seat, who never even got a hearing. So now Democrats are realizing they have a lever to pull as well. And it's up to Senator Chuck Grassley, the head of the Judiciary Committee, really to decide if he wants to continue to honor this rule.
And has he said anything about it yet?
As of a few moments ago, I don't think he has.
Okay, so we will wait for Chuck Grassley. Let's turn now to this California bill. It would require presidential candidates to release their tax returns in order to get on the primary ballot. No secret who this is aimed at. And the legislature approved this. We're still awaiting the signature from Governor Brown. What do you think of this?
Well, you know, this is one of those examples of one instance of behavior that we don't like is potentially creating a systemic change. And so what do I think of this? I think that tax returns provide the public with important information about our candidates, arguably a lot more important than a stump speech. So what does their financial outlook look like? What are their charitable contributions? Who do they have potential conflicts of interest with? And so it really does provide us with, I think, maybe more than going on the website and for someone to say, you know, I really care about kids and education and rainbows and sunshine, which everybody who's running for office has. There's a legal question here as to whether or not it's even permissible. Now, states can require certain ballot access kind of procedural rules, like you need a certain number of signatures, or you need to pay a certain filing fee, or you need to submit your papers by a certain time. States can't add qualifications like, you know, in other states to be president, you only have to be 35, but in California, you have to be 77. So the question legally really is, does it fall within the new qualification bucket or does it fall within the ballot access kind of procedural bucket? And I think there are some serious questions there. Those questions may prevent Governor Brown, who hasn't released his taxes for the first time, I think, in 30 years, a California governor, not doing that. And so it may prevent him from signing this bill at all.
And it would only be presidential candidates, though. So it wouldn't be gubernatorial candidates or sitting governors or anything like that.
Right. I mean, this is very well tailored to California. And it's not just California. I believe it's actually now the majority of states have similar proposals. Huh. It's geared towards states saying, President Trump, we really don't like the fact that you didn't release your tax returns.
So in 2020, you're going to have to do that to be on the ballot.
Exactly. To the extent that Governor Brown signs it and it's upheld. Yeah. Lots of ifs.
Lots of ifs. OK. Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Here's President Trump talking about the violent Charlottesville demonstration a month ago.
I've condemned neo-Nazis. I've condemned many different groups, but not all of those people were neo-Nazis, believe me. Not all of those people were white supremacists. I think there's blame on both sides. You look at both sides. I think there's blame on both sides, and I have no doubt about it.
Both sides. His comments have renewed concerns that he is emboldening white supremacists and neo-Nazis. For writer Philip Occhiale, President Trump's rhetoric is reminiscent of another leader from another time, the mayor of Vienna, Karl Luger. Luger was mayor from 1897 until he died in 1910. A big part of his appeal was whipping up anti-Semitism, although he would have been horrified to see where that ended up, the purging and extermination of most of the city's Jews a couple of decades later. Philip Occhiale wrote about Luger and his similarity to Trump in the magazine Granta, and he's here now. Welcome.
Thank you, Madeline. Hello.
Luger was mayor of Vienna during a prosperous and largely peaceful time. Tell us more about how he waged this verbal campaign against Jews.
Well, he was the leader of a nationalist party. Of course, Vienna was a very multi-ethnic city. It was the capital of a multi-ethnic empire. in which the Germans were actually a minority, even though they were originally the majority in Vienna and the area around. So it was a period when people were very sensitive to ideas about immigration and the ethnic Germans becoming a minority in their own city. He found the simplest way to build a political coalition was just to focus on minorities, the danger they posed to the German people.
And yet he had Jewish friends. He was considered tolerant. Was he just doing this for political expediency?
Yes, yes. He probably you have to think about the late 19th century and the earliest 20th century. It was a time of belief and progress. It was a time when people didn't believe that what happened later, that civilization could actually fall apart in Europe. They didn't believe that that would happen. They didn't believe that there'd be regimes that used political terrorism or that executed their own people in millions. They didn't believe that. So it was rhetoric. It was hateful rhetoric. But in Vienna at that time, in Luger's time, which was before the First World War, it wasn't a particularly dangerous place, despite the language that he used. But there was a man who lived there at the same time called Adolf Hitler, and he listened to this. He saw how you could use this kind of rhetoric to create a kind of focus in politics, to get people behind you.
Did he ever cite Luger as an influence on him?
I think in Mein Kampf he does mention him, among others, as an influence, as one of the German politicians who was solidly pro-German. But he wasn't a German nationalist in the sense that he was looking for German Austria and Germany to unite. He wasn't that kind of nationalist, which Hitler really admired.
And are you saying that by drawing parallels between Luger and Donald Trump, that he could be creating a similar environment that would give some kind of confidence to a future type of leader like Adolf Hitler?
I'm saying we don't know, but these things start with words. And for a long time, people have been very nervous of the kind of language that Donald Trump uses about immigrants and about minorities, simply because we have this memory of what happened last time. I'm talking about the Second World War and the genocide and the Holocaust. But we tend to be lulled. We tend to imagine that because we live in a safe, comfortable country that's governed by laws and protect our individual rights, that it can't ever fall apart. And once we become too complacent about democracy and these kind of rights, that's when they start to erode. When people are being demagogic without having any real sense of history or interest in history, I don't think Donald Trump or Steve Bannon actually know very much about history. You know, you listen to Steve Bannon, he talks about history in his recent interview for, I think it was CBS. And he talks about history a lot. He refers to it. If you don't actually know what he's talking about, it sounds like he knows something. So whether we like it or not, people build narratives using history to justify their politics. But we actually have to go back and remember what actually did happen, that democracies did fall apart. They're exceptional systems in that they tend not to last, they tend to decay.
Yeah, and we tend to think of ourselves as exceptional here in the United States with our democracy and our way of our system of government. But if you could make some parallels between what's happening here in the United States in terms of our political movement and our embrace now, at least in the White House, of nationalism, and what was happening in the Austro-Hungarian Empire?
Well, what's happening now in the United States is a simplification about politics. It's politics that's not actually about issues anymore and issues being debated. Once you start to bring in the fear element, the fear of the immigrants who are coming in, the fear of a religious minority in the case of the United States, the Muslims, that they're somehow associated with a global terrorist plot, a kind of conspiracy against American values. Once you bring all these in together and make this the center of politics, everything else starts to disappear. Even in reacting to it, you're sort of being sucked into the vortex of it, this kind of mindless politics. And really at this point, you start to see that a large part of politics is never about what people seem to be talking about. It's never actually about being reasonable. We like to imagine that reason is at the center of our public discourse. But most of politics can rapidly become very unreasonable. It can simply be about perceptions of what's happening. And in this case, it's a victim narrative. You tell people they're victims of foreigners or Muslims or that everyone's trying to humiliate your country. People react to this very quickly in a very personal way. It's a very emotional reaction. And it's exactly what happened in Europe in the 1930s. All the peoples who became perpetrators did so because they originally conceived of themselves as victims. All the failings in their country were down to the immigrants coming in, or the minorities, or the Jews. It always came back to the Jews because that was the simplest thing to do.
You are the translator of a Romanian novel, first published in 1934, but just out this month in English, and it's called For 2,000 Years. It was written by a Jewish intellectual who describes in pretty brutal detail the anti-Semitism he encountered as a college student in Romania between the world wars. And one striking part of this is that he has a lot of friends who are non-Jews, who are intellectuals, and they too are swept up in this anti-Semitism. So it's not just the unwashed masses, if you will, who don't know history. It is these supposedly civilized, if you will, public intellectuals who are also caught up in this fervent anti-Semitism.
And it didn't only happen in Germany. It was throughout Europe. You look at Heidegger in Germany, you look at Céline in France, you look at Knut Hamsun in Norway, you look at Ezra Pound. Ezra Pound ended up broadcasting for the fascists, and he was as obsessed with Jews as Hitler was. And you had, Romania was a particularly extreme case though. The entire intellectual class became swept up with this nationalist ideology in the 1930s. There were very few exceptions of people who didn't adopt this nationalist narrative. And Sebastian, he's right in the middle of it. He was one of them. So as he's describing this in For 2,000 Years, the book that has just appeared, he's describing a world he knows personally. He's not even doing it as an outsider, as a victim of fascism. And he made it his priority in his writing to describe how it happened, not to stop at his own suffering, but to actually try to analyze how it was occurring.
Why is this book, which I said was published a long time ago in 1934, why is it now just being translated into English and published here?
There's an interest in the 1930s at the moment because of these parallels we're talking about. There's a desire again to remember what happened last time things really fell apart and why they happened. So in a time when people are abusing history, it's certainly time for people who know real history to come forward. How this book actually came just to be published at this time is in a way an accident. I translated actually, I think it was about 10 years ago I finished translating it, and it remained unpublished for about 6 years. I could not interest any publisher in it. And then suddenly last year it came out in Britain in Penguin. As an editor there heard about it. And it did very well. People really did relate to this story. The book is being presented as fiction, but it's actually so vivid and real, and you have all these conversations between people that are ideologically charged, and it really comes out as something very immediate and easy to read, and gives us an access to a time that we don't really have by reading history, which is much harder to approach. There's a lot to be said for what we sometimes call fiction, because it gives expression to very personal experience.
And when you were translating it, did it then make you think about the parallels with today? Or had you already been thinking about that and that's why you were attracted to it?
No, I was attracted to it primarily by the narrator of the writer. There was something very solitary about him and his vocation to observe the things around him. Because he saw that people around him were going nuts with this obsession with ideology. Everyone seemed to have an idea about the world and to be emotionally stirred by all these ideas, whether they be nationalism or communism or Zionism. And he's kind of the eye of the storm. He decides just to stay calm. He's not going to get committed in any way. His only commitment is to his idea of himself as a writer and an individual. It allows him to observe very well and record very well and very coolly, very analytically. And that's something that's very rare in any time.
Well, I want to thank you so much. Interesting conversation.
And thank you, Madeline.
That's Philip Occhiali. He's the translator of the novel For 2,000 Years. It's out just this month. And you can read his essay, The Decay of Politics, in Granta magazine.